Thanks for coming to my talk. My name is Mona Al-Tahawi. And when South by Southwest contacted me last year and said, come and talk about anything, I was really bad at getting back to them because I'm constantly traveling. I'm perpetually jet lagged. So I didn't send them a title for my talk for ages. And they kept saying, send anything, send anything. So at the time, I remember in the middle of last year especially, I was especially frustrated that every time I gave a talk about the revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa, I was always asked all these really gloomy questions. What if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? Why aren't you people more pessimistic? So I told my contact at South by Southwest that I wanted to call my talk Optimism, because I believe that optimism is the ultimate revolutionary act. And I didn't think twice about it. I sent it to her and, you know, months go by. And then in November, my arms were broken by Egyptian riot police and I was sexually assaulted and I was detained for 12 hours. And I totally forgot about this title of the talk. And then I was preparing to come over last week and I thought, oh shit, I'm going to talk about optimism. And a lot of very pessimistic things have been happening, both to the region and to myself. But the more I thought about it, and I've just come back from Cairo. I got back from Cairo on Friday. I've been going back to Egypt almost obsessively since I was attacked very close to Tahrir Square in November. And the more I think about it, the more I understand that the optimism that I had, that I wanted to share last year when I gave this title, was really an optimism without consequence. And it was an optimism that lacked depth. And I'm not there anymore. And I'm actually very glad, as bizarre as it sounds, that I was attacked and that my arms were broken and that I was sexually assaulted, because I now feel an optimism with consequence. I felt that consequence around my arms. I've got the consequence in my arm until the end of the year because I have a titanium plate with 5 screws that are keeping my bone in place. I felt the consequence in between my legs when I was sexually assaulted. I felt the consequence in the trauma, that the physically stronger I get, the more it really hits me emotionally what happened to me. But despite all of that, I'm still optimistic. And it's an optimism, as I said, with consequence. And it's a much deeper and a much stronger optimism than the one that I had in mind when I suggested this talk last year. And then this morning I woke up to news that this young woman here, I don't know if those of you in the back can see her, but her name is Samira Ibrahim. I was marching in Cairo on International Women's Day, March 8th, with this woman. I spent many hours with her, and she epitomizes for me optimism with consequence. And the optimism that I'm going to share with you isn't political or philosophical, but it's people-based and it's story-based, because that's the only way that I deal with the world, by sharing with you the stories that I know that I go out there and collect. And this woman's story is nothing short but stunning and exhilarating and inspiring and full of optimism, as I'll explain why. At this time last year, exactly a year ago, a few weeks after Hosni Mubarak was forced to step down after 18 days of the Egyptian revolution, the Egyptian military, which took over, where Egypt is now run by a military junta, broke up the demonstrations in Tahrir Square that remained, because there was still a core group of people that were convinced that Egypt must revert to civilian rule. We've been under military rule since 1952. And even though a lot of people were happy to see the military on the streets, because the military seemed to be, ostensibly, were protecting people against Mubarak security forces, from the beginning, the military were detaining people, torturing people, and intimidating people. So this idea that you would hear from Egypt soon after Mubarak's downfall, that the military and the people are one hand, this core group of revolutionaries that refused to leave Tahrir Square knew that this was not the case. And among them was this amazing young woman called Samira Ibrahim, 26 years old, from an upper Egyptian town called Suhag, from an ordinary middle class, quite conservative Egyptian family, but who spent most of her time, all of her time, during the revolution in Tahrir Square. So when the military broke up the protests in the square, they took the men and women, first of all, to the Egyptian Museum, and then they took them to a military jail where they divided them, separated them. They beat and tortured most of them, but even more, in an even more sinister and shameful display, I believe, of military excess, they separated the women into the married women and the non-married women. And so Samira, who is not married, was on the non-married side. And the whole point of this was to separate the virgins from the non-virgins. Because a lawyer who was there when these women were taken into detention told the army, be careful now, because you're now responsible for these women. And if anything happens to them, you're going to be accused of dishonoring them, quote unquote. That is sexually assaulting or raping these women who are virgins. And so the military subjected to these women, including Samira Ibrahim, about 17 of them, to so-called virginity tests. These so-called virginity tests are nothing short but rape. It's basically a medical doctor who inserts his fingers into the vaginal opening to look for a hymen. None of this is optimistic, I know, but give me some time, I'll get there. So Samira and these 17 other women were subjected to this horrendous sexual violation. And then when they were released, one of them spoke out. One of them called Salwa al-Husseini, and nobody believed her. Everybody called her a liar and much, much worse. But she insisted on speaking out. She exposed what happened to her, and she gave video testimony that a lot of people uploaded on YouTube and that went viral, in which she said, she explained very clearly what happened to her. And at the time, nobody wanted to believe this because everyone held on to this myth, this dream that the military and the people are one hand. Several months pass, and still no one believed this young woman. And then an Egyptian reporter called Shahira Amin, broke the story to CNN, in which she got an Egyptian general who spoke off the record, who said, yes, we did perform these so-called virginity tests on these women. And then he went on to make it even worse by saying, thinking that he had a reason for this. He was giving the rationale, and the rationale was, but these are not girls like your girls and my girls. They're not like your daughters and my daughters. These are the kind of women who would spend night after night in Tahrir Square in tents with men, i.e. they're bad women, they deserve what happened to them. And the reason that they were subjected to these sexual violations is because they didn't want the military didn't want them to accuse them of raping them, as if only virgins could be raped. And that's why they carried out these tests. Again, no one would believe these women because it was such a horrific thought that our honorable military would do these to these women. And then Samira Ibrahim came out and she said, I'm suing the military. And everybody was stunned. And this is where the optimism comes out. Because what possesses a 26-year-old from Upper Egypt, from a conservative family, whose father was imprisoned by Hosni Mubarak's regime for 25 years, what possesses a woman like this to stand up to 19 generals? That's our military junta. I always say we replaced one Hosni Mubarak with 19 Hosni Mubaraks, and they're his friends from the military. This is the military junta. So what possesses this woman to stand up to them and say, no, and stand up to them and say, I deserve justice? What possessed her is optimism, because it was this drive that pushed Egyptians out onto the street, that pushed Tunisians out onto the street and inspired us in Egypt, that after Egypt rose up, pushed Libyans and Yemenis and Bahrainis and Syrians and so many others across the region who left their houses and said no, because this is essentially what Samira said. And not only did she say no, but she said this must stop, because there were two aspects to her case. The first aspect was to take it before a judge and have it accepted as a trial, as a court case. And that first step determined that indeed military jails do subject women in Egypt to these so-called virginity tests. And that first step ended that. Because of this woman, Egyptian women who end up in military jail for whatever reason will no longer be subjected to these sexual violations. And the second part of her trial was to show other ordinary Egyptians that you might not have any backing. Right now we've got Hosni Mubarak and his sons and his former ministers being tried in a civilian court in a trial that most people don't take very seriously and don't think will give Egypt any kind of justice. But she went the harder route. She went through a military court because the doctor was a military doctor, this medic who subjected her to this sexual violation. And so you can imagine how the odds were stacked against her, because you've got a military court, a military judge trying a military doctor, because this woman exposed a military sexual violation. So, I mean, from the very beginning, you could have said, forget it, Samira, you're going to lose. And today she actually did lose. This is the sad part of the story. But she hasn't given up, because what she did by speaking out and breaking the silence is put on the Egyptian revolution front and center what I think is the most optimistic angle of it, which is the gender angle. Not a lot of people will tell you that the Egyptian revolution is about gender. They will tell you it was about freedom, it is about dignity, it is about the right to speak out. But all of that, at the heart of all of that, is gender. Because if the Mubarak regime oppressed all of Egypt, then Egyptian society and Egyptian culture oppresses women. And this is where gender comes in. Samira and myself and so many other Egyptian women who are involved in this revolution are involved in two revolutions. There isn't just one revolution that we're fighting here. We're fighting a revolution that began against the regime, but we're continuing a revolution against a culture and a society that allowed these virginity tests to happen. Because the army, the military did not invent these virginity tests. And that's what keeps me optimistic about Egypt, that this is coming out. The fact that Samira Ibrahim goes on television and speaks about this horrendous sexual violation, the fact that other Egyptian women have been going on TV and media and speaking about this, have forced Egypt, all of these women have forced Egypt to look internally and ask, how do we make our political revolution succeed? How do we stay optimistic in light of these terrible setbacks? Because she lost today. She lost because a military judge took the side of the military. No big surprise there. But right after she lost, and this is again where the optimism comes in, and this is what keeps me optimistic. Right after she lost, she went with three other Egyptian women to the Ministry of Defense and stood there in protest and said, I will continue to demand justice. When I was walking with her on International Women's Day, from the Egyptian Journalism Union to Egyptian Parliament, I asked her, are you optimistic, Samira? Because I, quite honestly, I was worried about her mental well-being, because I know what the trauma is like. We suffer different things at the hands of Egyptian security. But as I said, the physically stronger I get, the more it hits me emotionally. So I wanted to know how she was doing. So I said to her, Samira, how are you doing? Are you okay emotionally? How's the trauma hitting you? And she said, I've never been better. She said, I was treated for 2 months because she suffered a lot of physical, as well as emotional trauma. But I said to her, so are you optimistic? And I thought she was going to say, you know, I'm going to lose. The military is going to take the side of their doctor. But she said, of course I'm optimistic. And I said, why? And she said, because look at us marching today. All of the Egyptians who are younger than us, and she's only 26, but the majority of Egypt is younger than 30. She said, all the Egyptians who are younger than me, younger than Samira, are watching us right now, and they're learning. And they're learning what it's like and what it means to stand up and to say no. And they're learning what it's like to stand up to a regime and a culture and a society. And she was telling me this, and literally, as we were walking, there was a mother and her daughter walking in front of us. And what she was saying was embodied right there. And at one point, the soldiers stopped our protests. They wouldn't let us continue on to Parliament. The reason we were going to Parliament was that we wanted to hand over demands. The demands had actually already been handed over, but it was a symbolic march there to remind the Egyptian Parliament, and I'm going to get to them in a minute, that Egyptian women are not going away. And so at one point they stopped us, and they wouldn't let our procession go through. And Samira just went right under a barricade, and she yelled at me. She said, Mona, get here, come here, we're going through. And we went through, and she forced the soldiers and the police to make way for us. But it was just me and her and two other women at first. So she pushed her way through these soldiers and police, and she started chanting against the military. She started chanting down, down with military rule, right there in the middle of three armored vehicles and a whole row of Egyptian police and Egyptian soldiers. And there was another younger woman with us who was holding up a sign that just said 50%. And it was symbolized what our demands to Parliament were. And that was that the Egyptian Constituent Assembly, which will soon be formed, it's supposed to be named by March the 24th, must have at least 50% women on this Constituent Assembly. And so there's this an even younger woman than Samira, and she's just holding up the sign. And we get to a group of soldiers in barbed wire. And she goes up to them with her sign, and she says, let me through. And at first they said no. And she said, I'm going through. And they just pushed aside the barbed wire and let her go through. I cannot underestimate or overestimate or exaggerate in any sense of the word what that means for a woman who's about 22 or 23 to go up to soldiers in Egypt and say, push aside your barbed wire, I'm going through. This is why I remain optimistic. And they continued every step of the way, every barricade we came across, until we got to right next to Parliament. The cordon was too big and we couldn't push beyond them. But to march with all of these incredibly courageous women and women who have suffered, like Samira, but survived, because she doesn't consider herself a victim. She's definitely a survivor. To march with women like that and to have them go up to soldiers and to have them go up to police and say, let me through, This is what keeps me optimistic. And this is at a time, this is where I get to Parliament now, this is at a time when you look at the political landscape in Egypt and there really isn't a lot to celebrate. The revolution was not launched by Islamists, but the Egyptian Parliament is now dominated by Islamists. And if we were really honest with each other, this is not something that should have surprised us, because no one on the ground in Egypt was as prepared for the elections that took place starting in November as the Islamist groups were. To their credit, the Islamist groups in Egypt gave social services to people, filled in the gaps that the Egyptian regime did not fill for a very long time. So they had connections to the people on the ground, they had a very strong and powerful network, and they were prepared. When you hear about the Egyptian revolution and when it started, and I'm going to talk about other countries in the region, but I'm focusing on Egypt because Egypt is the biggest country in the region, and if Egypt works, I fully believe all the countries in the region work. So I'm going to talk about Egypt more than the others, but I will get to the others. If you looked at the makeup of the Egyptian revolution, you hear a lot about how it was a bunch of kids who were on social media who got together their friends through Twitter and Facebook, but you know better than to call it a Twitter-Facebook revolution. We've gone through this. This was not a social media revolution. But you'll still hear that it was a lot of these kids in Tahrir Square, upper-middle-class kids, who were the heart of the revolution, and it's just simply not true. Because if you continue to believe that, then you are missing out on a whole lot of reasons why I and many other Egyptians are optimistic. The people who were protecting Tahrir Square against Mubarak's thugs and against even the soldiers and against the attacks of the camels and the horses that came on a terrible on February the 2nd were ordinary working class and quite poor Egyptians. And they got involved in the revolution because they understood what it meant to get rid of a regime that also violated them on many levels. You had two groups of people that you rarely hear about who are protecting the revolution. One was a group of football supporters called the Ultras. They're often called football hooligans because they will get into fights with each other, as a lot of sports fans and people in sports clubs do. But the Ultras were on the front lines of Tahrir Square and many other squares across the country, protecting the revolution against security. And they had a personal stake. Their personal stake was that they have a long-running vendetta with Egyptian police. And so when they had the chance to go out there and face Egyptian police on a level playing field, even though it wasn't level, because the police had weapons and the Ultras didn't, they went out there. But you rarely hear about them, and it's important to talk about the Ultras and the working class origins of most of these Ultras young men, because it was optimism that took them out onto the street. These are the young people that have no future. These are the young people for a very long time who had been dying to escape from Egypt, and literally dying, because every summer we would have ferries that would leave Egypt for southern Europe full of Egyptian men dying to escape their country, and the ferries would drown because they were overpacked with these young men trying to escape. When the revolution started, this is where the optimism kicked in, because all of a sudden they all understood what it was like to fight for their country. They were out on the streets of Tahrir Square, Alexandria, Suez, other parts of Egypt, fighting for their country, because they knew this was finally the chance to stand up to the regime. But the other group of people that you don't hear about enough is the youth of the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is what keeps me optimistic when we talk about Parliament, because there isn't a lot to be optimistic about Parliament right now. When Samira's verdict was announced, and so many of us felt heartbroken for her, Egyptian Parliament, even though they're Islamists and very conservative and always talk about women in very conservative terms, and you would think they would get very upset at this dishonor that the Egyptian army visited upon Samira, even though Samira very wisely said today, nothing violated my honor, it's Egypt's honor that was violated, and I will restore it. But our Islamist members of Parliament said nothing about this verdict. Instead, they've spent the past few weeks busily trying to ban internet porn sites. So it just shows you the big schism now that is developing between these Islamists and Parliament, and what is actually happening to a lot of people from the revolution who paved the way for the Islamists to take over, or to win elections, basically. And so it remains in the hands of people like Samira, but more importantly, in the youth of the Muslim Brotherhood. And what keeps me optimistic about the Muslim Brotherhood as a whole is that as a structure, it's very similar to the structure of a dictator and his state, because it's top down, the supreme guide decides what's going to happen, the supreme guide gives out his orders, and everyone is supposed to listen. And so when the January 25th protests were called for in Egypt last year, the Muslim Brotherhood supreme guide said, we're not taking part in these protests. But the young members of the Muslim Brotherhood broke rank, and they, alongside the Ultras, helped to protect Tahrir Square. And the reason they keep me optimistic is because just like Mubarak and the old men of the military junta will disappear. Well, Mubarak has disappeared in that he's not in, the president of Egypt anymore. But just as all these old men will die, because they are very old and Egypt is very young, the Muslim Brotherhood will itself start to undergo an internal revolution because of these young members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And these young members of the Muslim Brotherhood, they shift back and forth between their allegiance to the movement, but also their allegiance to the revolution, because they understand what many of us understand in Egypt. And again, this is what keeps me optimistic. There's a triangle in Egypt right now. I want you to imagine Egypt as a triangle. On one point of the triangle is the military, with the military junta on the top. On the other point of the triangle is the Islamists, and these are the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis in our parliament. But the third point of the triangle, which is the most important point for me, and what keeps this balance of the triangle, is the revolution. And that point of the triangle, the revolution, is people like Samira Ibrahim and the young members of the Muslim Brotherhood that go back and forth. Now, our parliamentarians understand that their challenge is immense. They have to create jobs for a lot of unemployed young people in Egypt, because again, Egypt is a very young country. So their challenge is get out there and actually create jobs. Get out there and fix the Egyptian economy. Egypt has lost a lot of tourism since the revolution started, mostly because of these attacks that our military has been, military and security have been so expert at acting out. But also, a lot of remittances, the Suez Canal income, a lot of these things that, can make Egypt rich have been funneled by a lot of corruption and nepotism. Egypt should not be as poor as it is. And so the burden on the parliamentarians right now is immense. So they will have to deliver. And they're caught right now between an ideology and politics. And it's my firm belief, and again, this keeps me optimistic, that the more they move away from ideology and towards politics, the more they will become dirty with politics. Because eventually, politics will make you dirty. But politics will always also bring you down on the ground where the rest of us are, where those of us who are fighting against Mubarak's regime are, and where the young members of the Muslim Brotherhood are right now. And it's on the ground that they will meet people like Samira Ibrahim, their young members, the ultras, who will tell them that if you don't deliver these jobs, 4 or 5 years from now, we will vote you out. So I'm not scared of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists in the Egyptian parliament do not make me optimistic, because they, just like the Egyptian state, have been shaken to the core. Their Mubarak might still be in place, the supreme guide might still be in place, but the supreme guide now is often put in a very awkward position whenever the politics steps in, because the Muslim Brotherhood now has a political party called the Freedom and Justice Party, and they will often make statements and comments that are diametrically opposed to the ideology of the movement, and that puts them diametrically opposed to the supreme guide, and sooner or later that clash will have to happen. And that clash is just like the clash that happened between the Egyptian people and Mubarak, and the clash that is happening between Samira Ibrahim and women like her and the military. It's the clash of those of us who are ruled and those of us and those of them who rule us. And the supreme guide rules Egypt. So it's really important to see the Islamists in that context, because I get a lot of questions asking me, well, you guys had this revolution and you basically handed it over to the Islamists. And I say, well, the Islamists are Egyptian. The Islamists won. The elections were a mess. They were not completely free and fair, but the Islamists did win the majority of quite a messy election, but nonetheless they won. But they have to perform now. And what's happening in Egypt is, I think, what is inspiring the entire world. What is happening in Egypt and what is happening in the region is we're finally getting to the nitty-gritty of what this is all about. And that is the relationship between the ruled and the ruler. Because when you look at Occupy Wall Street, and you look at what happened in various European countries, and you look at why what's happening in the Middle East and North Africa is captivating so many people's imagination, it's because it forces you to ask, what would I do if I feel my government doesn't represent me anymore? It forces you as the ruled to ask, what is your relationship with those who rule you? And I hear a lot in the US, because people constantly have this argument on my Twitter feed. Well, we have elections, we don't have a dictator, we don't have the police on the street breaking our arms. But what is your relationship with those who rule you supposedly democratically? Because five of your administrations, now my administrations, because I'm a US citizen now, five US administrations supported Hosni Mubarak, knowing that he was a dictator. The current US administration continues to sell weapons to regimes like Bahrain. And the Bahraini revolution has been going on now for more than a year. The Bahrainis rise up almost every 2 years. Why does our administration sell weapons to the Bahraini regime? Why does our administration want Bashar al-Assad to go because he's slaughtering people and he should go, but our administration says nothing about Bahrain. Why? Those are the kind of questions that what's happening in the Middle East and North Africa are forcing us to ask. Now, the answers are many, obviously. Iran, the Shia Sunni Muslim thing, Israel, geopolitics essentially. But it puts us in that awkward position that pushed out a lot of Egyptians onto the street because they got to the point where the questions had to turn into optimism, because you can't launch a revolution without optimism. If you do not believe that those who rule you must be held accountable by you, those who were ruled, then you don't go out on the street. There is no revolution in history that was launched because of pessimism. And there is no revolution in history that was launched by the majority. It's the minority that launches a revolution. And in order for a minority to launch a revolution, it has to be undergoing an almost hysterical amount of optimism in order for it to surmount all the obstacles that it knows are in its way. What possesses someone who's 26 years old, again, to stand up to a military junta? Now, if I take that to a context that is even harder than the Egyptian context and move on to Saudi Arabia, there is a young woman there, another one, she's about 32 years old, called Manalah Sharif, who I had the pleasure to meet in January. Manalah Sharif is a one-woman revolutionary. In May of last year, she got into her car. As many of you might know, Saudi Arabia prohibits women from driving. It claims that this is against Islamic teachings. It's absolute nonsense, because Saudi Arabia is the only Muslim-majority country on earth that bans women from driving. So it's Saudi Arabia's own internal cultural being that bans women from driving. But this woman called Manalah Sharif, 32 years old, a single mother of a five-year-old boy, got into her car in May of last year. She's not the first Saudi woman to have done this, but she did it, and it turned into a huge splash. And she got a friend to film her, and she posted the video. Again, she's not the first woman to do this. But she was the first woman to do this after the revolutions and uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa had started. So it was a perfect moment. Nobody in the region, just as I said, nobody across the world can watch what's happening and not ask that question about what's my relationship as the ruled with the ruler. The same, no one in Saudi Arabia, which has been under this absolute monarchy for decades, has not asked that question. And so Manalah Sharif asked that question, and it pushed her again into an act of optimism, because here is this one woman standing up to the law, basically, in Saudi Arabia, got into her car, posted this YouTube video, and then went out again the next day and did it. But the next day when she went out with her brother. Her brother was in the car with her. And it's important to remember this, because in Saudi Arabia, I lived in Saudi Arabia for about 6 years. They were the six most difficult years of my life. But I often say, as a woman in Saudi Arabia, you have two options. You either lose your mind or you become a feminist. So I became a feminist. And Manalah Sharif is obviously a feminist. But her brother's also a feminist, or at least a feminist ally, because he got into the car with her and she drove. She didn't get arrested on the spot, but the police went to her house later and arrested her. And they took her in and they imprisoned her for 9 days. They jailed her for 9 days. And the only reason that she agreed to sign a statement promising, vowing never to drive again and break the law is because her young son, her five-year-old son, was taken ill and taken to the hospital. And they used this against her, because as I said, she's a single mother. But they had the police outside Manalah Sharif's apartment for about 4 hours, negotiating with her it was 3 a.m. Why would the police force of a country in which the monarchy is absolutely in charge, why would they send police to the home of a woman, a single mother, at 3 in the morning for 4 hours, basically surrounding her house and insisting that she go to jail with them if she didn't represent some kind of existential threat to them? This is where the optimism comes in. This is why this woman is a one-woman revolutionary. So Manalah Sharif, I met her at a Yahoo conference on women changing the world in the region in Cairo in January. And they asked her, how do you continue? And this is to go to the source of her optimism. She was asked, Manalah Sharif, how do you continue, even though you are imprisoned? And she told the story, a very moving story, and she had us all crying with this story. She told the story of a woman called Aisha, who she got to know through her one-woman revolution. And this woman is, again, a single mother of two daughters. One of them is 12 and one of them is 14. And this Saudi woman called Aisha left her husband because he wanted to marry their two daughters off. One is 12 and one is 14. And she refused to allow him to marry these two girls off. But now, as a single mother of these two teenage girls, She didn't have a way to get around. She wasn't rich enough to hire a driver, because this is another fallacy, that all Saudis are rich, all Saudi women can afford drivers, so why do they need to drive? Why don't you just hire a driver instead? And not all Saudi women are rich, not all Saudis are rich, and some Saudi women want to drive their own car, damn it, is what Minhal Sharif was saying. And so she meets this woman who says to her, I didn't have a driver, I didn't have money to hire a driver, I needed to get to my job, and my daughters needed to go to school, and we have no man in the house. And so what did we do? She said, I saw what you did, Minhal, and I contacted a woman, because they set up a list of women who could drive and who have driver's licenses and who volunteered to teach other Saudi women to drive. This is where the optimism now becomes infectious. Who volunteered to teach other Saudi women to drive, and they taught, not this woman, because she said she was too scared to learn how to drive, but they taught her daughters to drive. And so you now have a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old who drive their mother to work and drive themselves to school in Saudi Arabia. And Minhal Sharif said this woman called Aisha had her face covered. She wore niqab when she was talking to Minhal. But Minhal said, even though I couldn't see her face, I could just see her eyes, and they were full of tears, and she was shaking as she was talking to Minhal. She was shaking and she was saying to her, thank you for helping me get out of this mess that I was in. She left her husband, and now her two daughters are the drivers of the family. So Minhal said, despite the days in prison, and despite the intimidation and threats from Saudi security, she continues because of women like Aisha. And again, this is where the optimism comes in. Because why would you do it unless you thought that you stood a chance? And women in Saudi Arabia aren't the minority numerically. On Saudi campuses, at least 65% of students are women. Saudi women are much more educated than Saudi men. But once they get their diplomas and they hang them up on the walls of their apartments, all the misogyny kicks right back in. And just a couple of days ago, in an unprecedented demonstration, protest in a Saudi university, thousands of Saudi female students refused to go to class in a university called King Khalid University in the city of Abha, because they were protesting conditions on campus, because the cleaning services weren't coming as regularly as they should, and these women just said, we're not coming to class. These are women who just refused to go. They were on strike, essentially. So when you think about a woman like Minhal Sharif, and you think about the optimism that drove her out, and I said to her, Minhal, what is it like now? And she said to me, she said they fucked with the wrong woman when they put me in prison. She literally said this. So when you think of a woman like that, and you think about the optimism that pushed her out onto the street, and that has become this infectious inspiration to so many other women, when I look at the Saudi royal family, and again, it's a bunch of old men, I know that eventually their days will be numbered. Because you can't fight this. You can't fight this kind of optimism. And if I take this now to Yemen, if Saudi Arabia is perceived as the richest country in the region, and I just told you they're not all rich, but in terms of material wealth, it's definitely way, way ahead of Yemen. Yemen is Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor, and much maligned neighbor because of the way Saudis treat the Yemenis. If you look at the Yemeni revolution, and I'm going to put, this should not have gone to sleep. I'm going to put a picture, a slideshow up as I talk to you about Yemen and the Yemeni revolution. Okay. There. Whoops. Okay, I'm lost. Okay, here we go. Yeah. All right. So Yemen. Thanks. I'm good. So just watch these women as I tell you about the Yemeni revolution. Because last week I was in Beirut speaking on a panel on women and the revolutions. And one of the panelists was a Yemeni woman called Hana Essayer. And she's about 27. And she took part in this revolution. She was one of these many women that you see in these pictures. And she told this great story about what the revolution has done to her family. She said when it first started, she was going out to change square in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, and at first just watching what was happening and then taking part. And she wouldn't tell her family where she was. If you speak to most young people in Egypt, in Yemen, in so many of the countries that are rising up, but I know so many of them in Egypt, they do not tell their parents they're going out to the protests. One young man I know, and this is men and women, it's not just the women. One young man I know in the run-up to the January 25th anniversary told his parents he was going to Sinai for 3 days and booked himself into a hotel in downtown Cairo so that he could protest, because his family had no idea, because they were so worried about him, and a lot of families are so worried. So when all these revolutions succeed, and they will, you're going to get a whole generation of young people across the region telling their parents, by the way, I made this happen, but you had no idea. And so this woman was going to change square, and she was protesting every day, and she would go back home as if she'd been at work all day. And then one day she just couldn't take it anymore, because her father was telling her, you see those people in Change Square? Do you know what they want? You know, what is going on? And she thought he was just asking philosophically. She said to him, I am one of those people. I am a revolutionary. I go to Change Square every day, and we're fighting the regime. Her father supported her, but her two brothers didn't. They were much more conservative than her father. She got into a very heated argument with one of her brothers, and he was about to hit her. And her father kicked him out of the house. And he said to him, don't come back, because no one is going to beat a revolutionary. And she and her brother haven't spoken in 5 months. But that kind of family dynamic is replicated across the region. It's a family dynamic that is not just pitted parents against children, but as in Hannah's case, brothers and sisters, and people in the same families who are for and against the revolution. But when you hear Hannah talk about the women in the revolution, and the kinds of things they do to escape getting arrested, because the Yemeni regime, like many of the other regimes in the region, knew that if you go in and you attack, you can attack everybody. But if you go and sexually assault women, that is going to go straight to the heart of the conservatism that essentially still grips the entire region. Because once you start sexually assaulting the women, then their families will say, you can't go out anymore. Hence, they will not tell their families they're on the street. And so she said a lot of the women, she didn't cover her face, but a lot of women in Yemen do cover their face. Even those who didn't cover their face, they would go to the square, and then some media would come up to them and say, can we talk to you? And they would immediately cover their face because they knew what was at stake. They didn't want to be seen, and they used the face veil in this very, very subversive way. I have a strong position, which I'm not going to get into right now, about face veils and how I feel about them as a Muslim woman. But the way they were used to subvert security and attacks in Yemen's revolution is genius, because the women would go out there, some of them would remove their face veil because they wanted to be seen and be known by fellow revolutionaries, but then they would use the face veil again as a way of getting around security and media so that their families wouldn't use their face and their visibility against them. So I would hear these stories from someone like Hannah and what she's planning now. She said you would go into Change Square, and she said regardless of your age, there were all these tents that were set up. And she knows a lot about social movements and planning and getting young people out on the street. So she said she would just sit there in the middle of a tent and start talking about how to get young people involved in social movements. And she said she had these 70 and 60-year-old men buzzing around her because they wanted to know. There was a thirst for wanting to know. And unlike the Egyptian revolution, which a lot of us followed 24 hours a day, the Yemeni revolution largely went unnoticed, unfortunately. But it's incredible in such a poor country, in such a conservative country, to see how many hundreds of thousands of women and men went out onto the streets of their country. Now, their revolution has also taken a bit of a difficult turn, because they got rid of Ali Abdullah Saleh, or he said, I'm leaving, and held elections in which just one man ran, and that was Ali Abdullah Saleh's deputy. So they essentially got rid of one Mubarak, we replaced him by 19. They got rid of one Ali Abdullah Saleh after 33 years in power and replaced him with his deputy, which is not a happy ending. But the Yemenis continue to fight, and to fight peacefully. Yemen is one of the most armed societies on earth. Per capita, apparently, Yemen is even more armed than the United States. And that's saying something. The number of weapons that people have there in comparison to the population. But no one in Yemen went out with weapons. No one in Yemen went out onto the streets to rise up against Ali Abdullah Saleh, although they could have. I hear from my journalist friends, you go into any market in Yemen and you can buy any weapon you want, even a bazooka if you want. But no one went out onto the streets of the Yemeni revolution with weapons, because they knew that their optimism was the biggest weapon they had against the Ali Abdullah Saleh regime. And this is exactly what makes optimism the ultimate revolutionary act. Because if the military junta in Egypt strips us of our optimism, if the Ali Abdullah Saleh regime, which remains in the form of his deputy, if any of the regimes in the region strip us of our optimism, they are stripping us of our strongest weapon. We could have gone out with weapons in Egypt. They could have gone out with weapons in Yemen. But we understand our strongest weapon is our optimism. If I go to Libya now, where things did take a turn for the militaristic, when they started the revolution in Libya, in the eastern province, women and the gender issue was a big deal, even though it wasn't talked about a lot at the beginning, because it was basically the wives and the sisters and the daughters of thousands of men that the Gaddafi regime slaughtered in a jail called Abu Salim in 2006, who would hold these regular protests. And there was a protest on February the 15th that they held against the detention of a lawyer who was representing them in this case. The Gaddafi regime tried to buy them off and they refused. They said no, just like Samira said no, we're going to take this to court. It never made it to court, but the attorney representing them was detained and these women went out. And it was basically the women in Libya that pushed out others to go out and demonstrate in the east, in Benghazi. Now, the Libyan revolution did take a militaristic turn. We had NATO intervene. We had weapons. We saw weapons. We saw the fight. We saw what happened to Gaddafi. I wish they had not killed Gaddafi. I detested Gaddafi. I had a run-in myself with Gaddafi. So it took more of a negative and a sinister turn. But I remain still optimistic for the Libyans, because Libya is a country that basically has nothing. Gaddafi left them with nothing, except a lot of oil, which I hope they will use to build their country. Because we have institutions, albeit crumbling institutions, in Libya. We have ministries. We have a civil society that again is attacked severely by the regime and continues to be attacked severely by the regime. A lot of non-governmental organizations have representatives on trial in Egypt right now. But in Libya, Gaddafi left them with nothing. And yet the people went out on the streets. A writer friend of mine called Hisham Matar, whose father is one of the many disappeared in the because of the Gaddafi regime. His nephew, his two cousins and his uncle went out to fight peacefully at the beginning. But then after a while, he said they ended up taking out hunting rifles and knives onto the streets because they couldn't stand up to the onslaught of Gaddafi's troops. But they still went out. Even though they had nothing, they still went out. When you go to Syria and you see how the Syrian revolution began, It began not so much as a gender issue, but as a children's issue. Because in Syria last year, when the revolution began, it was about 10 to 12 children in a city called Daraa. The revolution in Egypt began in the capital. The revolution in Libya began in the eastern province, which was considered freer than the other parts of Libya, because these were the tribes that were not the allies of Gaddafi. These were the tribes that were neglected by Gaddafi. And yet they had enough optimism to push them out onto the streets. In Syria, the revolution did not begin in the capital because because of the complicated relationship between the Syrian regime and the business class and the Republican Guard, which forms the backbone of the Syrian regime. The revolution had to start somewhere away, far from the center of power. And it couldn't have been more beautifully put than being started by children in this town, far away from the capital, far away from the centralized authority. Because remember, again, it's a very young region. And these were literally children. Children between the age of 8 to 15 who scrawled on the wall in this town called Daraa, the people want the downfall of the regime. And this was to mimic the chant that you would hear again and again across various cities in the Middle East or North Africa who are rising up. Ashab, Yurid, Asgard, and Nizam. So these children between the age of 8 to 15 were scrawling this. It was just graffiti on a wall. And they were arrested and they were jailed for days. Who jails children? The Assad regime jails children. A Syrian I know was imprisoned. He is a Syrian dissident called Yassin Al-Hajj Saleh. I met him in Damascus in 2008. I've met Syrians who have been imprisoned for decades. This particular man was imprisoned for 16 years by Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current dictator of Syria. I've met other Syrians who've been imprisoned for 17, 20 years, and I don't know how they stay sane. They have questions, they have conversations with you, they laugh, they talk, they eat, they watch films, and they somehow stay sane, despite the fact that they were jailed for 16 years. And this particular man, Yassin al-Hajj Saleh, was jailed for 16 years from the age of 19 to 35. Is that right? My math is terrible. Anyway, 16 years. And he was sitting there joking with me over lunch one day in Damascus about how opinion writing is very dangerous. And I'm an opinion writer. And I said, I know, people hate you, right? And he said, they don't just hate me. I've lost all my friends. No one's left. Every time I write an opinion piece, I lose someone. So he's sitting there joking about what he does. And during the Egyptian revolution, he came up on GChat And he sent me a message. He just said, I am in Damascus, but today my heart is in Cairo. Because he understood the magnitude of what was happening in Egypt. Today, Yassin al-Hash Saleh, I don't know where he is, but he's safe. And he's apparently in between houses in Syria. Every day he spends the night in a different place. And when I found out when I was in Cairo a few weeks ago from a Swedish journalist that she was going to Syria and she had plans to meet him, she had somehow made plans to meet him, I said to her, tell Yassin that today I'm in Cairo, but my heart is in Damascus. Because what is happening in Damascus is nothing short of miraculous. What is happening in all of Syria? Because when the revolution started in Tunisia and then inspired Egypt and then inspired all those other countries, every regime in the region would be saying, we are not so-and-so. And so the Egyptian regime said, Egypt is not Tunisia. And then Egypt started revolting. And then Libya said, Libya is not Egypt. And then Libya started revolting, and so on and so forth. Nobody imagined that Syria would start revolting, because a lot of people would often say that Syria is the North Korea of the Middle East and North Africa because of the absolute control of the Assad regime. Bashar al-Assad and the old men around him from his father's regime. So to think that Yassin al-Hash Saleh, my friend, is somewhere, again fueled by optimism despite 16 years in jail, but fighting to get rid of the son of the man who put him in jail for 16 years, makes me incredibly optimistic. Almost every month, the Syrian regime has, well, they've slaughtered at least 10,000 people. But there are human rights activists who remain on social media who tell us what's happening. And one of them is a woman whose Twitter handle is Red Razan. She comes on, and she's been in prison twice so far by the Syrian regime. She comes on and she says, I am not a hero. I'm not a hero for spending 2 weeks in jail. The heroes are those who remain in jail. The heroes are those who go out on the streets. The heroes are those, the citizen journalists, who demand that we, the outside world, watch what is happening. Because one thing that the Assad regime has done very well is to stop those who bear witness to go in and to show us what is happening. You all know about Marie Colvin, the veteran war correspondent who was killed in Homs. But do you know about the Syrian citizen journalists who've been killed getting the word out? Several of them have been killed, and all they've been killed for is that they go out on the street with their smartphones, with their video cameras, and film the onslaught on cities like Homs and upload it onto YouTube and tell the world, watch. And you're watching not just the onslaught, and you're watching not just the slaughter, but you're watching again this unbelievable hysterical optimism that despite the slaughter keeps the people going out. I asked a film crew who was in Syria a few weeks ago what the people on the ground are telling them. And they're telling them, we will not be silent anymore. We are ready to die for the right and the freedom to speak. Just to speak. There isn't even a list of demands that these ordinary people, I mean, there's the Syrian National Council, there's the Free Syrian Army, there's a whole lot of organizations right now that are speaking on behalf of the Syrian revolution. But when you speak to the people on the ground, they tell you, we are fighting and we are ready to die just for the right to speak. Because it is that down to the wire, the right to speak. And so when I talk about people like Samir Ibrahim, and I talk about why they're optimistic, and I watch Egyptians argue with each other on Twitter, and I wonder about Iran, because in 2009, Iran had a similar uprising. And I remember at the time when the Iranians rose up with the Green Movement, we had heated and intense discussions on social media asking, why the hell are the Iranians able to rise up and we can't? Is it something among Arabs? Is it something? Is it because we're Sunni and they're Shia? You know, all these bizarre discussions were happening. And no one could figure it out. It was like every 30 years these Iranians rise up. Why can't we do it? And a lot of the young people I know who were involved in the Egyptian revolution were inspired by what happened in 2009. And so now I can't help but think about the Iranians watching now, those they inspired rising up, and knowing for sure that they too will rise up, because you can't imprison optimism. You can imprison people, and you can kill people, and you can kill people, break people's bones and sexually assault them, but you cannot kill that optimism. There was a young Iranian man I met on a panel I spoke at a few months ago on some college campus here. And he was very bitter, and he was very upset, and he said, stop being so optimistic. So many of my friends are in jail. So many of my friends are dead. Why are you so optimistic? But I said to him, if we don't have optimism, what do we have? I understand where your bitterness comes from. But I told him, I have friends in Egypt who've lost 14 friends. I have friends in Egypt who've lost their eyes. I have friends in Egypt who have been killed on the day that I was assaulted in Tahrir Square. a distant relative of mine was shot dead in Alexandria. One of the most iconic images of people who died in Egypt is a cleric from Al-Azhar University, which is the seat of Sunni Muslim Islam. And he and I grew up together. We used to play together as children in my grandparents' home, because my parents moved to the UK when I was 7 and left us with my grandparents. And me and this man, Sheikh Ahmad Afat, his name is, we grew up playing together. We would run between my grandfather's study and his father's study. And the idea that this childhood friend of mine was killed in the revolution, I mean, that really brings it home to you. It has consequence. And I found out he was killed about a week after my bones were broken. And I found out by complete chance, because I read in the news that this cleric was killed. And he'd been seen in Tahrir Square. And he said something very poignant. He said, the spirit, the air in Tahrir Square, is purer than the air in Mecca. And that is the holiest place for Muslims, where Muslims pray towards 5 times a day, and where we go on pilgrimage. He said that the atmosphere in Tahrir Square is purer than the atmosphere that I encountered in Mecca. And so I was talking to my mom on the phone, and she said, did you hear what happened to Ahmed? And I said, Ahmed who? And she said, Ahmed, who you grew up with in Cairo. And his funeral was packed. Muslims, Christians, atheists, everybody. You had priests marching alongside clerics in this man's funeral. Because he represented that kind of optimism, because he broke away with the establishment, because he firmly belonged to an establishment, that was Al-Azhar, that for too long had been co-opted. The religious establishment in Egypt had for too long been co-opted by the regime. But men like Ahmed Afat understood what it meant to go out there and demand to take your country back. Now I'm widening the lens a bit. I'm not just focusing on gender. Gender is the issue that is closest to my heart. Gender is the issue that I believe will launch the second revolution in Egypt. But when I look at people like Ahmed Afat, what took him out on the street? He's a father of 3 children. What took him out on the street? When I look at men like Ahmed Harara, whose picture I'm going to get for you now. Okay, let's see, where is Ahmed? Oh, I'm not going to get his picture because I can't move this thing. Could you come up here for a second, please? Get a picture that is at the end of my screen and I can't get it out. It's back here. I just want to get a picture that's back there. Because of the size. Can you do it? I just want to end with this picture, so.
I wasn't there when they changed the settings.
Yeah, it was your co-worker who did it for me. Ah, that's it, yeah. You go down there. You know what? Let me get late.
Wait, who's going to come back? You're going to scroll by me. Side scroll, scroll
up. Yeah, go there.
This one?
Yes. Yes, okay. Is one of the Egyptians that I know who lost both eyes. This man is called Ahmed Harara, and each one of his eye patches has the date of when he lost his eye. He lost one eye on January the 28th and another eye in November, on the week that I was attacked. He, along with the artist behind this picture, keep me optimistic. Can you see this picture? At the back you can't, but I can't make it any bigger than this. I'm going to end with this picture because on the day when I marched with women to Parliament, I ended the day by going to an art exhibit called Tank Girl. And Tank Girl, as you can see, it's a woman who's wearing a red bikini top. She's sitting, she straddles a tank, and from the tank's oversized cannon, very phallically symbolized here, come out rats. And the artist behind this picture is a woman called Nadine Hammam. And she put this picture right here is what is happening in Egypt and what keeps me optimistic. You've got women fighting the military, you've got women fighting misogyny, and you've got women using everything they own to subvert all of these things. And you've got women who are optimistic that this can change. And on the wall, she's got this huge sign that says, go love yourself. But obviously she means go fuck yourself. And that's what keeps me optimistic about the revolution. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.